The president speaks. Do the Chinese listen? Beijing and the TPP coming up. Also, the economics of the metric system and a return to Euler. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 4th of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We're going to start with a thread that got teased out of our interview with the president yesterday. The news that China has reached out to the White House about getting in on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal the administration is pushing. They have sent out feelers, is what the president said. On the theory that some ears in Beijing probably perked up when they heard that, we've reached out to Andy Rothman for a little perspective on this. He's a longtime China watcher, currently the investment strategist at Matthews Asia in San Francisco. Andy, it's good to have you back on.
Good to be back. Thank you.
I figure there's a news clipping service over in Beijing for the Chinese leadership. And I like to think that our interview with the president yesterday made it in there, what he had to say about China reaching out for the TPP. How do you suppose that went over?
I think that the Chinese government will be very pleased that you got President Obama to announce publicly for the first time, I think, that the Chinese and the U.S. are talking informally about eventual Chinese participation in the TPP. We know that there's been informal conversations for more than a year, but it's been kind of behind the scenes.
What might those talks look like? Because, as you know, Chinese-American talks are always contentious.
Well, these talks, I think, are at a very preliminary stage, largely because the bar that the U.S. is setting for countries to join the TPP is pretty high. At the same time, we need to also keep in mind that there's a lot of other stuff going on out there. The Chinese and the U.S. are having much more detailed conversations about a bilateral investment treaty known as a BIT. Mm-hmm. And that's likely to happen a lot earlier than China joining the TPP.
The president's operating philosophy on the TPP in China is that we're going to write the rules. We, the United States, are going to write the rules so that the Chinese don't get a chance to write the rules. And I asked him if he thought the Chinese would follow American rules or TPP rules if they get written. What do you think?
Well, I think it's too bad, actually, that the president is describing it that way, because what China wants to do is have a hand in writing the rules. And that's really what trade negotiations are about. It's everybody getting together and writing the rules. And in fact, that's worked really well for us in the past. If we look at the WTO, for example, since China has joined the WTO, U.S. exports to China are up by more than 600%, whereas during that time, U.S. exports to the rest of our major trading partners are only up by 100%.
Net-net, in the end, do you think China becomes part of the TPP?
Yes, but I think that's going to take a very long time. I doubt that the TPP will even come to life without China in the next couple of years. It's going to take time. But in the meantime, we need to make sure that we keep bringing China into more trade agreements like the bilateral investment treaty, because these have always proven to be good for the U.S.
So friends close, but your enemies closer, if you will?
Definitely. And it's had a really positive impact on China, both as a market for us and also in making China wealthier and more stable, which means that from a strategic standpoint, they're less likely to fight with us.
Andy Rothman lived and worked in China for many years. He's now the investment strategist at Matthews Asia up in San Francisco. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Investments on Wall Street today, not so good, not good at all. In fact, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Once upon a time, we got phone service from the phone company, cable service from the cable company, wireless from a cell phone company, and never the twain, or never the threesome, I guess, did meet. And then came bundling, a menu of services from the same company. But now, given the rise of mobile, growth, which is to say survival, hinges mostly on one thing, wireless spectrum. So entire companies are getting bundled, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Merger talks between Dish Network and T-Mobile are the latest in a flurry of deals which could reshape the telecommunications industry.
The deal makes sense. It makes sense for both of them.
Jeff Kagan is a telecom industry analyst. What all of these deals come down to, he says, is reaching customers on their wireless devices.
Instead of it being new and a novelty, all the competitors are going to be jumping into the same space offering the same kind of delivery methods because that's what customers are going to want. And if you don't offer it, you're going to go out of business.
But unlike previous mergers, say between your internet and cell phone company, to roll out wireless streaming, you need spectrum, lots of it. Think of it as the invisible signal that delivers the content to your device.
You're really seeing a bit of an arms race right now in terms of, or a land grab in terms of getting some of the spectrum under ownership.
Jim Breen is an analyst with William Blair. Spectrum, he says, is a finite resource. There's only so much of it. And Dish has been buying up spectrum at government auction for years. What it doesn't have is a wireless carrier. T-Mobile has the wireless network and wants more spectrum.
It would put them on par with AT&T and even slightly ahead of Verizon in terms of the total spectrum capacity that they have.
Breen says this marriage of a TV company with a wireless carrier has raised concerns from regulators in the past. Those fears seem to be waning, as many expect the government to soon okay the proposed $49 billion merger of AT&T and DirecTV. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Lincoln Chafee, the former senator from Rhode Island and current but about to be out of office governor, also a former Republican, by the way, has announced that he is running for the Democratic presidential nomination. A key platform issue for Mr. Chafee? The metric system. He said, and this is a quote, "The economic benefits outweigh the costs of changing all the signs." Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has more on our uneven history with the measurement system used by everybody else.
Well, not quite everyone. Liberia and Myanmar are still holding out, but it wasn't always so lonely. The U.S. started down the highway to metrication, but never quite finished. Don Hilger, the president of the U.S. Metric Association, says the golden period for metric fans was around 1980.
Many former British Commonwealth English-speaking countries in the world decided that they were going to adopt a metric system.
Canada went metric in the 1970s. They had a plan and a public awareness campaign. In this ad, a snowman explains it.
3 centimeters is a light snowfall. 100 centimeters of snow is an awful lot of snow.
That's what works, apparently, a cultural change that helps people imagine the differences between old and new. Hilger says the problem here is the Metric Conversion Act of 1975 had one deadly word, voluntary.
I think they thought that, well, it would probably happen because big, larger companies change and then other ones follow.
As you know, that didn't quite happen, but Elizabeth Gentry, the metric coordinator at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, says a lot of big companies did convert after that act, Caterpillar, GM, IBM, plus an entire industry, booze.
And they modified the law to permit the use of metric units on the packaging.
She says that business-focused change helped Americans become comfortable with liters and grams. That's why you know what a 2-liter bottle of Coke looks like. In fact, metric is officially America's preferred system for trade and commerce, like meters in the office, inches at home. This exact problem was identified in our own metric commercial from the 1970s.
Although all scientists use Celsius thermometers, only the poor American scientist has to go home to Fahrenheit.
And that is still our problem today. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, our education correspondent Amy Scott did a series of stories about a school in Cincinnati, Ohio that was trying to do something different. Trying to take kids from a low-income neighborhood and give them the kinds of support outside of class that they weren't getting at home. Stuff like healthcare and mentoring and food and clothing. And they were doing it in the hopes that that would help those kids succeed in class. Euler School, it's called. Last week, Amy took us back to see how the school itself is doing. Today, a recent graduate, because getting a high school diploma is often just the first step out of poverty. Here's Amy.
When I first met Raven Gribbins almost 3 years ago, she was 17 and a senior at Euler. Her light brown hair was slicked back in a ponytail after volleyball practice. Here's how she described growing up in Cincinnati's Lower Price Hill.
It been rough, but it been okay, too. Everybody used to tell me all the time, like, you're not going to make it through high school. You're going to have a baby by 16. So I'm glad to prove all of them wrong.
Today, Raven is a sophomore at Penn State Greater Allegheny, a small campus outside Pittsburgh. Her long hair is dyed black to match her name. In her African and African-American art class, she sits right in front and speaks up during a discussion about hip-hop poetry.
Miss Raven, what you think, sister?
I thought it was very creative, and I liked the voice, like the background.
And her old teenage defiance now sounds a bit more like confidence.
Since I've been here, I done grew up a lot more. I learned to be on my own and to be the first in my family to go to college and to make it here and still be here. It's a good feeling.
Raven almost didn't make it when she started college last year.
I was like, hey, college is going to be, oh, you get to turn up and drink and have fun and don't worry about schoolwork.
She ended up flunking several classes. As a result, she lost her financial aid for this year and had to borrow more than $18,000 to stay in school. Her bad grades also got her tossed from the volleyball team. Volleyball was the reason she'd been recruited to Penn State.
It broke my heart going to the games. It tore me down. I should be out there. So I was like, I can't do it no more. I got to get my stuff together. Like, I got to get these grades up so I can play.
So she's been getting help.
Hi, how are you?
From people like April Bellback.
Miss April.
Hello. Bellback runs a program called ACE, the Center for Academic and Career Excellence. It's a federally funded support program for low-income and first-generation college students. Raven comes for tutoring and workshops and advice about classes. Today, they talk about a presentation she'll give later in her criminal justice class.
Do you want to practice?
Nope.
You ready, ready?
Yeah, I practice all night.
You have a PowerPoint?
Nope.
So you have note cards for it?
I have a paper.
Okay, let me see.
Woman.
Notice how Bellback doesn't let up? This is what's known as intrusive advising. It's a strategy to keep at-risk students on track. Bellback says last year she needed to intrude a lot more. She went to Raven's classes to make sure she showed up. Sometimes she'd even wake her up for class.
She just doesn't need me to do that anymore, which is kind of cool. You know, she's able to handle the class schedule more. The second year, I just feel like she's coming into her own.
Raven also changed her major this year from education, she had wanted to be a math teacher, to criminal justice. And she's brought her grades up enough to get her aid back and play volleyball again next fall.
It's me being nagging. I mean, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but it's the... It's all of us as a campus that have really helped her and have really, you know, said, we need you back here and we want to see you with a college degree because that's what's going to make the difference in your life.
But Raven's second year hasn't been easy either. Her dad, who'd been clean for almost 7 years, started using heroin for a while. Raven blamed herself for not being around. And her grandfather, who pretty much raised her, got really sick.
A lot of times I was ready to just transfer and be back home with my family. But my grandpa wants me to be up here doing what I got to do, so I'm going to do it for him, to prove to him that he raised a great granddaughter, and I'm going to make something out of my life to show him that we could do it.
There is a lot of pressure on Raven. For one thing, this reporter, me, keeps showing up, tracking her progress on national radio. A mentor who heard one of those stories pays half of Raven's tuition. And a close cousin who finished high school the same year dropped out of college after one semester.
It makes me feel like I can't fail. Like, if I fail, then I'm letting my whole family and everybody else down.
All right, everybody, zip. Go ahead, Raven.
Okay, my name is Raven Gribbins. My presentation is on domestic violence.
That evening, Raven gives her talk in front of her criminal justice class.
How many of you have been or known somebody that was in an abusive relationship? I know some people myself. That is called domestic violence.
She's nervous, but she nails it. And afterward, we go out for milkshakes. A guy who's visiting from Cincinnati, just a friend, she says, comes along. On the ride back, Raven fiddles with the radio and then chats with another guy on the phone. Guy number one sits in the back seat, getting increasingly agitated. When we get to Raven's dorm, she tells him to wait outside while we finish the interview in my car. She tells me she wants to be a juvenile probation officer and work with kids in her old neighborhood.
Because then I could tell him, like, look, hey, I came from the same place you did. Look where I'm at. You could do the same.
Meanwhile, her visitor has started yelling outside Raven's dorm. Someone calls the cops. Raven jumps out of the car to see what's going on. After a while, the guy is led away in handcuffs.
Hey, but you ain't leaving no way, bro.
Raven almost was, too.
The cop talked to me the way he talked to me one more time. I was about to go to jail with him.
What happened?
Life.
Life. The old one keeps threatening to pull Raven back as she tries to build a new one. In McKeesport, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy shot a documentary film while she was reporting at Euler. We've got a trailer for it on our website. You're going to want to check it out. It's a good one. Also, the whole radio series she did, also good. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
From the crazy baby stealing ones to the kidnapping stories to the romance ones.
Movies on the Lifetime Channel that make fun of movies on the Lifetime Channel. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 170 points today, about 0.9%, ended things at 17,905. The NASDAQ off 40 points, 0.8%. 5,059. The S&P 500 down 18 points, 0.8%, 2,095. Dish Networks beamed up 4.8% today on that possible merger we told you about earlier with T-Mobile. Shares of T-Mobile up 2.6%. A dip in oil prices hit energy companies again. ExxonMobil moved down 0.8%. Transocean sale down 3.7%. Chesapeake Energy off 3.8%. J.M. Smucker, the maker of Folgers coffee, slipped 3.75%. Today, its fiscal fourth quarter earnings missed expectations. The firm said higher coffee bean prices and a strong dollar were partly to blame. What about the jam, though, and the jelly? Smucker, right? Come on. Brown-Forman, the maker of Jack Daniel's whiskey, sweetened 1.75%. Today, its fiscal fourth quarter revenue beat expectations. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. What does the employment situation look like? In Washington, the Labor Department issues the May jobs report. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for April. And have you seen this one in your Twitter feed yet? Tomorrow is National Donut Day. Brace yourselves for the early morning sugar high. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. When you get home tonight, maybe after you've hit the gym, I don't know, you might grab a quick shower. You'll probably wash the dishes, and at some point, you're going to go to the bathroom. You get where I'm going with this, right? All of those things take water. We've been thinking a lot about water out here in California, drought and all. But people in Detroit are thinking about it, too, because the city has started shutting off water for possibly thousands of people who are behind on their bills and not, oh, by the way, for the very first time. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has that story.
People freaked out about these shutoffs when they first started happening last year. They made national news. It made international news. And Mayor Mike Duggan was quick to respond.
I don't know how to filter water and pipe it from the river to somebody's house at no cost.
That is him last August defending the city's decision to shut off water to people not paying their bills.
Right now, it is other Detroiters paying for it, and there are a lot of Detroiters paying a water bill who can't afford to be paying other people's bills as well.
So that was when Duggan offered up this different solution, payment plans. Basically, people could pay what they owed the water department a little bit at a time, so long as they stayed current on their new bills.
You have to stick to the payment arrangement.
But here's the thing. People didn't. At one point over the winter, nearly every single person who had gotten onto these payment plans had fallen off, including Andrea Malone. Malone is a single mom. She has a daughter who's 9. The daughter's been in and out of the hospital.
I missed a payment because I had to pay another bill. It was either pay the water or pay the electricity or buy food or pay her hospital bill. So I'm robbing Peter to pay Paul.
So today, Malone is calling up the water department.
You have reached the customer care call center at the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department.
Now, like a lot of people in Detroit right now, Malone is trying to get back on the payment plans now that the city is once again shutting off people's water.
Ashley, I'm calling to get my balance.
As of right now, the city says there are about 30,000 people currently on these payment plans. But about 18,000 people are late enough and owe enough on their water bills to be in shut-off status. Andrea is okay for right now. She has still got some time to pay down her total balance.
$537.68.
So Malone says she's going to do what she can do. She's going to try to borrow money from her ex. She might pawn her DVD player. But then what?
Do you feel like you can stay on the plan?
Not really. Like I said, it's tough. It's either pay the water bill or get it shut off. And I can't be without water, so I'm struggling.
So right now, it kind of looks like there is this cycle happening in Detroit. The city shuts off people's water, so people get on payment plans. But then people fall off the payment plans, and the city shuts off people's water.
The plan was not successful based on what we've all agreed success should be measured by.
This is Gary Brown. He runs all of Detroit City Services. And he is suggesting something new. It's called an affordability plan. What does that mean? It means charging low-income people less for water.
Because that really speaks to the poverty that's going on in our city.
The city council has put together a work group to really try to dig into this idea. Councilwoman Janae Ayers says the city has to figure something out.
We can't have that many people without water. I can't sleep at night knowing that.
But the city's legal department says this could all get very messy. It points to a Michigan law that says city rates have to be based on the actual cost of service, not on what people can afford. Other city council members have said, well, okay, let's get creative. Maybe we offer subsidies or something. But Mayor Mike Duggan is skeptical.
People move every day. How would you ever figure out what the income is in a household from one day to the next?
Actually, other cities already do this. Cleveland for one, Portland, Oregon for another. So it may not be impossible. And for his part, Duggan is reminding people, look, there is financial assistance available if you are low income and you're behind on your water bills. That pot of money is about $3 million. Detroiters owe the water department about $47 million. In Detroit, I'm Kate Wells for Marketplace.
Lifetime, the cable network loved and laughed at for its over-the-top dramatic movies, is poking a little bit of fun at itself. They're advertising a new movie called A Deadly Adoption, starring Kristen Wiig and Will Ferrell. It's expected to be a campy, over-the-top spoof of the Lifetime movie genre, but there is a marketing challenge there, right? Because how exactly do you pull that off without alienating fans of the real thing? Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on it.
What is it about those salacious, outrageous Lifetime movies that keep us coming back for more? Well, they're kind of awesome. Take this trailer for the new high school thriller, Double Daddy.
I got the blood results back. I'm for sure pregnant.
I'm pregnant, too.
He doesn't love you.
Emily Newman's been a Lifetime movie fan for a long time.
From the crazy baby-stealing ones to the kidnapping stories to the romance ones.
She's also an art professor at Texas A&M University Commerce, and she's writing a book on Lifetime. She says there's something about the Lifetime brand of drama and camp that she loves. And the Will Ferrell spoof, she's excited.
Most Lifetime viewers are in on the joke. I mean, we know we're watching these movies that can be just sort of ridiculous and terrible and over the top. And that's part of the fun of it.
This does, it seems, raise another important question.
I mean, how do you parody a parody?
That's David Isaacs. He's a professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts and the co-head of the Comedy at SCA initiative. The trick to pulling it off, he says, is just playing it dead on, straight ahead. But he thinks regardless of the quality of A Deadly Adoption, Lifetime's already scored.
When you're competing with so many other broadcast entities, cable, pay, this gives them a absolute promotional bonanza, I would suppose.
Which probably deserves its own scream. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one last mention of the video version of our interview with President Obama. You can find out, among other things, why we don't let him hold the microphone all by himself. Oh, and there's some good trade policy stuff in there as well. Also, WikiLeaks still has that $100,000 reward out for a copy of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The crowdfunding thing that they're doing to pay for that, though, isn't working out so well. Almost $47,000 raised so far.
Marketplace is supported by Logitech's Harmony programmable remote controls that replaces up to 15 remotes with one, designed for simple setup and ease of use. More at logitech.com/harmony. And by Reputation.com, helping businesses and individuals make a strong positive impression on the Internet. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps. Learn more at Farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps.
And with that, we are out of here. The Dow off 170 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 40 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 off 18 points, also 0.8%. Jobs Day tomorrow, by the by. Friday, Jobs Day. Looking forward to it. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I am, by the way, really looking forward to jobs. It's just a thing. I don't know. Anyway, I'm Kyle Risdell. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.